You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my mom, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
Hi. Well, it's a beautiful day here in Iowa, and this is Grandma Pumice's birthday.
That's true, and that's who I'm named after.
That's right, yeah. Monica. That's
Monica
right.
Clements, and she was named after St. Monica because originally May 4th was St. Monica's feast day.
Yeah, they did change it in the Catholic calendar, but it was, and that's why she was named Monica, because she was born on that day.
That's,
yeah.
Yep. So happy birthday, Grandma, wherever you are.
Yes, indeed.
So we have today a really interesting book about dogs. And this is, it's a great book, even if you don't have a dog and aren't thinking of buying a dog, but it's really a good book to read if you do have a dog or are thinking about getting a dog.
Well, it's important. It's an important book because it tells you about how different breeds behave because of their DNA, and I think that's the most important thing you can know about your dog. I really do.
I think so, too, and it's amazing to me that more attention hasn't been put on this before, but we're going to get
the opportunity
to really discuss this. Our author today is Kim Brophy. She's an applied ethologist, certified dog behavior consultant, and developer of the LEGS dog behavior model and dog key software. She considers herself a lifetime dog nerd. Kim lives in Asheville, North Carolina, where she operates The Dog Door, a modern dog behavior center and storefront, as well as Dog City USA, a resource center for local and visiting dogs and their humans. Kim shares her mountain home with one impossibly patient husband, two remarkably inspiring kids, and a host of ridiculous dogs and cats. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Kim.
No, thanks for having me.
And I apologize for the technical difficulties we had getting started, but we're good to go
now.
No problem. So, Kim, you developed this LEGS system, Learning, Environment, Genetics, and Self, to answer questions about dog behavior. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, it was really more of a sense of obligation as opposed to inspiration that originally motivated me to write this book. My background is in applied ethology, which is an integrative discipline looking at the welfare of captive or domesticated species, and I focused on dogs. So having that background of multidisciplinary approach to welfare and behavior, I came out of school and decided I wanted to work with people and their dogs. And so I found myself in the dog training field, even though I really wanted to do something on a grander scope than that. But that's where I started. And about halfway through my career, I found myself very frustrated with the narrow presentation that dogs were given to dog owners as far as our appreciation for what was happening. So we would think about everything like it was all how you raised them. And if you just had the perfect dog training technique and you were just well skilled enough, and if you just did everything right, and then, or you possibly threw the right medication at the dog, that you could make them how you wanted them to be. And the goal and the focus was how to get them to do what we wanted them to do, as opposed to understanding why they were doing what they were doing in the first place and what all was going to go into their overall welfare and therefore the balance of our relationship with them and the health of our relationship with them. So about halfway through my career, I got really frustrated and I went back to my roots of applied ethology and the integrated sciences and just dug in researching through a variety of different disciplines independently and then integrating them, and of course found over and over again throughout all these different disciplines that they were talking about all of these elements that go into the welfare of all animals, not just dogs, not just people, but in the behavior of organisms on a much larger scale. And so these are really well-established principles in science are well-established principles of science that we actually just haven't applied to dogs yet. And maybe it's because we were overwhelmed because there's so much information out there and it's really hard to put the pieces together. So LEGS was my attempt to boil that down into something that was accessible, tangible, and useful for every dog lover out there.
So LEG stands for Learning, Environment, Genetics, and Self. And they're all important, and you can talk about what each of those means, but the book is primarily about the genetics of the various types of breeds. That's the largest part of the book, anyway. I wouldn't say it's not necessarily the most important, but maybe mm-hmm. It is. What do you think? What do you say?
Well, it's interesting because it definitely takes up the most space in the book. But when you are diving into the genetic section of the book, what you'll find over and over again is just more learning, environment, and self woven back into the conversations about the genetics. Because ultimately, all these things are working together at all times. I think what genetics provides is our point of reference, our starting point for the reality check. And I've used the example before that if you pick up a pen and you try to make a phone call with it, you'll be really frustrated. Or if you try to write with a phone, you're going to be really frustrated. And there's nothing wrong with either one. It's just that they were designed for different purposes. And it's just kind of a pragmatic way to think about a dog is remembering that they have these very diverse, long histories for different niches, different jobs, different performances, behavioral and physical characteristics that they were selected for by our ancestors. And they've become very distinct from each other as a result. And in this day and age, where we don't have most of those jobs or needs available for them anymore, we treat them uniformly like pets. And sometimes that creates a very erroneous starting point, similar to picking up that pen and trying to make a phone call with it.
So a dog is not just a dog.
No, that's the thing, is that for all intents and purposes, they are all different subspecies. They are that distinct from each other physically and behaviorally and in really important ways because of artificial selection.
So if you have two dogs or three dogs and they're all different breeds, then you have a lot of different behaviors.
If they're different groups, yes. So, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So if you had a herding dog and a scent hound and a guardian dog all in the same house, everything from their neuroethology, which is their sensory systems and the types of things in the environment that are going to be interesting or noticeable to them, or the types of things they're going to focus on or respond to their actual behavioral responses to that sensory information. So then when I become aroused by that particular event in the environment, what do I do with it? Do I chase it really fast and then stop without actually grabbing it, which would be like a herding dog behavior? Mm-hmm. Or do I stand there and watch the ball go through the room 30 times and don't bother to get up for it, like my guardian at home? You know, the big giant breed is like, you want me to take what? and then you have, my little terrier at home who's just like the Energizer bunny who doesn't even have an off switch until she passes out at the end of the day. I mean, those types of differences were designed into those dogs for different jobs.
And you group dogs into 10 categories. Are these categories that you designed, or are they kind of a standard known in the industry?
So many of them are the same as the AKC uses, with the most glaring exception being the AKC kind of catch-all non-sporting group, which is the ones that don't fall into the other categories. They go into the non-sporting group. But the herding dog, the hound group, the terrier group, those are similar to the AKC grouping. Now, the scent hound, I then break out into sight hounds and set hounds because they're very different from each other. And then we kind of flush out the non-sporting group a little more specifically, as well as separate out the bulldogs as a distinct group that evolved from the guardians.
You know, as I was reading through this, and I've had dogs companions most of my life. I haven't the last few years, although I've had people who lived with me who had dogs. But I find that almost all of my favorite breeds fall into one to two categories, one to two groups. Mm-hmm. The primary one being the natural dog. And, you know, I've had some of the breeds that are in the natural dog that I've had as pets include the American Eskimo, the Norwegian Elkhound, the Samoyed, the Keeshan, and the Siberian Husky. Yeah. And I would not necessarily have known that those were of a like group, but it makes sense that I would be attracted to that same type.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think a lot of people are both drawn to a certain type of dog, and then they also build their expectations about their relationships with a dog based on a type of dog that they're drawn to. And sometimes the things that they're really frustrated with about a new dog they get that might be from a totally different group from the ones they've had in the past is just because that dog has genetic software and therefore behaviors that are so distinct from their point of reference that they've had in the past that they think something is wrong when there's actually nothing wrong. The dog's just very distinct from the other types of dogs they've had as a point of reference.
Right.
The dog is just doing what the dog does, and he, you know.
Right.
And it, imagine how frustrating it is for the dog.
Oh, absolutely.
Just, you know, that's what really is, you know, I think everybody should have this book that has a dog. Really, I do.
And we see that so much where the dogs are just so chronically frustrated because the owner is so chronically frustrated trying to turn that square peg into a round peg to fit in the round hole. I mean, they might have always had golden retrievers, and then they go out and they get a husky, and they're like, well, why doesn't he immediately come when called just because I said his name, you know? or why does he try to escape the crate when I put him in there? Or why is he not Johnny on the spot bringing me the ball 50,000 times a day, you know? Whereas someone else who's had nothing but huskies might be complaining, why is this golden retriever bringing me the ball all day long, you know?
Why is it trying to climb on my lap?
Exactly, right? You know, why does he not understand what personal space is, for crying out loud? So, and really, we have a lot of people come in that think their dog is broken just because it's not measuring the expectation that they had from that prior type of dog that they had, or the ubiquitous kind of ideal they have in their head, which is often a golden retriever. If the dog doesn't fit that standard of behavior, then we think you have to fix it and make it that way.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Kim Brophy, author of Meet Your Dog, The Game-Changing Guide to Understanding Your Dog's Behavior, which is the official dog LEGS guide. So now, do you have a favorite among the groups, or would that be like asking if you have a favorite among your children?
I don't have a favorite, although there, it's funny that you brought up, you know, the natural group, because I have a profound appreciation and respect for dogs in the natural group. And at the beginning of my career, I can say that that wasn't so much the case, because I myself was guilty of what I was just describing, because I had spent most of my life around gun dogs and then some herding dogs. And so I had the expectation of, well, you're supposed to do what I want you to do because I'm the person, and the dog is supposed to want to do things for me. And so I teach you these things, and you're supposed to be really enthusiastic about wanting to do it all. And then I had my first few natural dog clients, and the dogs would just flippantly walk off in the other direction. And I was like, well, wait a minute, you know, what am I missing here? And then as I started to understand what was actually happening and how I had to work harder to earn the respect of those dogs, it actually makes me like them even more.
Well, when I had my Siberian Husky, I lived out in the country, and we lived on the highway, but I would go for walks in this woods that was just down, you know, you'd have to walk along the highway and then be in the woods. And I would start out the walk with the dog, and I'd end up the walk with the dog. But in between, the dog was off and running and running through the woods and, you know, just wherever she wanted to be, but she'd start with me and she'd end with me. And that was perfect for me.
Yeah, and you know, I love that. I mean, the understanding that that type of dog is going to move through space differently is just a remarkable insight, really, into their essence, their being, you know, who they fundamentally are. The border collie might not, you know, go further than, you know, 10 feet from you, and that's how you like to move through space with a dog, and that's how they like to move through space. But, you know, again, if you start the walk with the dog and you end the walk with the dog, we're good, right?
Right.
But that dog might be having their own autonomous experience in nature in between.
And I always felt very protected by that in a way, because she was scoping out the woods, make sure there wasn't anything dangerous in there.
Yeah.
Monica, was that the dog that if another dog would approach you and they would just look at her eyes and then...
Yeah, she was a blue-eyed husky, and she looked dangerous, but she wasn't really. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she looked a little scary. Yeah. And then we had the border collie who was very, very protective of my son, who was like 2 or 3 at the time, would not let anyone touch him if he did not want to be touched.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things with the herding dogs is kind of natural control freaks, if you will. They're very type A and very hypervigilant about what's going on in the environment. They feel very responsible. They have a strong work ethic, and so they can be very protective. They're usually controlling, even if they're not super protective, but because working with moving and managing sheep is part of their ancestry, then of course they're also going to have had a little side job in their job description as well of keeping watch for predators.
Right.
And so concerned with law and order and safety of the flock is absolutely at the top of their radar.
Wow. One of the categories you have is world dog. So what exactly is a world dog?
So a couple of things there that are really interesting. I think one of the things that's remarkable is that we in America tend to forget that 80% of the dogs on the planet are not actually living as pets and are not created through artificial selection. So, you know, for thousands of years, and then again in 80% of the undeveloped world, still dogs are free roaming, living alongside human beings, but not captive and not artificially selected. So in other words, nature is still the breeder. So you might see, you know, some of them look like relative mixed breeds of different dogs, but you know, most of them are highly watered down from any type of purebred, if they even had any purebred in there at all. They're more what's called land races, which is a breed, but a natural breed that is created because of the selections and pressures in a certain habitat or ecosystem or environment. And so the world dogs are really the dogs that were designed by nature. So that might be a dog that you, you know, get from the local paper or the local shelter, or just someone who happened to have a litter of one unaltered dog with another unaltered dog, and both of them having various backgrounds and mixed bloodlines, maybe living out in some rural area, and they've been watered down and no one is selecting for any one purpose. Nature is then back in the driver's seat, designing those dogs for adaptivity to circumstances.
Is it more difficult to characterize those dogs as having a typical personality because there's so many different combinations?
Absolutely, and I think that's kind of the cool thing about those dogs is they tend to be, if anything, just more adaptive, more go with the flow. They are going to be a quintessential dog right now, because adaptivity for a dog, we have to remember, is being really good at trash raiding, you know, and poop eating, scavenging, observing and manipulating human behavior. I mean, that's what dogs have been professionals at for thousands of years. And when left to their own devices with nature at the helm of the breeding again, that's what you're going to get selections for. So it's interesting, you know, when you see what happens when nature is doing the artistic creative work of genetics, you have a very svelte, adaptive, savvy animal.
Now, Kim, you... you score each of these groups on three different scales. Would you like to describe those?
Sure. So the scales that we talk about for them are the home life score, the public life score, and then personal life score. And we're rather than it being, you know, one being good, quote unquote, or five being bad when we're giving them those scores, it's more just on a range from, you know, for home life score, for example, from seriously challenging would be a one to the easy life would be a five. And it's really just going to help people understand how to calibrate their expectations for the indoor lifestyle, out and about in public lifestyle, and then the relationship that they might be having with the dog. And for the personal life score, for example, there, we're rating them from independent to codependent. And so your natural dogs, we were talking about a moment ago, they would be on the independent end of that spectrum, whereas the herding dog we were also talking about, your border collie, would be on the codependent side of that spectrum.
Mm-hmm. And home life, you go from seriously challenging to the easy life. And does that mean, like, for seriously challenging, that it's hard for that dog to be inside a lot?
Right, exactly. Or it could be hard for the dog to be inside a lot, or you could expect to have a lot of challenges with having the dog inside, maybe in company coming over. I think home life for most of it could include anything from, you know, children running around the house to lots of time spent confined, sedentary, and indoors to having company over. And so if you're looking at that score, you know, you want it's going to be calculating all those different things together. So, for instance, herding dogs are going to be more towards the seriously challenging when it comes to the home life score compared to something like a toy dog, which was absolutely bred for those circumstances.
I found it interesting.
Although the benefit with the herding dog is that they are more compliant, right? So with the training and with enough provisions for them outside the home, they can do great inside when they're there.
And also, if you it depends on whether you live in a crowded environment like a city, and you're going to be walking your dog where there's a lot of people, or you're in the country. That's going to make a big difference too, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, and when you get into the genetics section, it's constantly weaving back in all the other aspects of legs. And so it's going to weave in the other elements of your environment. So when we talk about home life, it's going to say, you know, we also need to be thinking about giving them enough opportunities to do all these other natural behaviors so that they can be successful when they're in the home. And so, you know, if that means, you know, living in the country or in a place where, you know, you can take your dog hiking on trails that are outside your back door four times a day are going to make that a lot easier for you to be successful when you do have company over at the end of the day. It's always a factor. And it's the complicated thing about legs and also the simple thing. It's a strange contradiction we have going on here because, again, I think one of the reasons people haven't talked about legs before, they haven't talked about the big picture, is it's almost daunting to have to think about all these things that actually matter so much and in so many different ways, depending on the legs of the dog. But legs at least gives us a framework and a point of reference for us all to come back to and say, well, let's look at the L, let's look at the E, let's look at the G, and look at the S so that we can at least talk about it. But it's always a dynamic interplay of variables.
Because most people, you know, they have a dog. They say, well, let's get a dog. That's it.
Right. Right.
And they may.
And then they
may
decide they like how one looks.
Exactly.
You know? Or
exactly.
They saw one somewhere and it was behaving really well. I mean, the perfect example, honestly, is the German Shepherd because they're so popular. And people see these really well-trained German Shepherds out in public and they go, oh, look at that dog. That's amazing. That's so impressive. I want one of those. They're so obedient. Well trained, and most people have absolutely no idea what they're signing up for when they bring a German Shepherd home. They're workaholic animals,
right? And I think another reason German Shepherds are so attractive, they're what we think of for seeing eye dogs. So we think, okay, if this dog can do that, it must be
right.
You know, a really, really great breed.
Right. And it must be, if it can do that, it would be easy for it to be a pet, right? That's right. Nothing compared to being a guide dog. And,
right.
You know, he's beautiful. He's from a good breeder. Check, 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 you know, and he's hip guaranteed. And I'm going to take him to puppy class and get the good food. Check, check, check. And then nobody talked about, yeah, but let's look at what the dog was designed for. And what the selections have been for. And then imagine the behavior that it was bred for in your living room. I tell people that's a really good exercise. If you want to think about whether a dog is good for you, research the history of the breed and what it was designed to do in the first place. Now imagine that behavior in your life. Right?
Right.
And then if he doesn't have the elk to hunt or what have you, then what else is going to substitute for that instinct in order to satisfy it, right? And it starts to get really crystal really quickly about, oh, maybe that's not exactly going to be a good fit.
Right. Monica, you know who would really love this book? Lauren.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
She lives on a ranch, but she has 6 dogs. Mm. And one of them is part wolf. And I'm not sure. I think she has a border collie now. But, yeah, I mean, oh, gosh.
Another group that I really found interesting because my son has dogs from this group, and one of my best friends who was staying with me for quite a while had a pit bull, so it's the bulldog. And, you know, there is this idea that these are all really aggressive dogs when they can be because they were bred for fighting, but they're actually, they want to be lap dogs when they're in the home. And I have that all the time. My son's boxer is always trying to climb on me and he's way too big.
Yeah. And you'll see that described in the bulldog chapter. I mean, I think actually, of course, that is one of the groups of dogs that people are most interested about what is in the book when it comes to, you know, any kind of comments on the genetics of, because we've unfortunately been caught in this really oversimplified, unrealistic, polarized debate about, you know, are they devils or are they angels? And of course, they're neither, you know. They're a dog, like all the other dogs, bred for a really specific set of behaviors in a very specific set of circumstances. And so what can happen, as for any of these dogs, is that circumstances arise that simulate or arouse the original context for which those behaviors they were bred for, you know, are going to manifest. And so, like for a bulldog, for instance, a highly arousing situation, especially if there's the sense of kind of competition in the air, you know, kind of think of the auditorium and the heat of the race and the revving of engines, then in that context, they were bred to be able to very matter-of-factly enter an altercation and to be very effective in altercation, but they're bred to be absolutely the most manageable, laid-back, tolerant, good-natured Sunday driving dogs up until that point. So the art of having a bulldog is just knowing how to keep them out of the situation that's going to arouse that particular set of behaviors on the off chance they're going to be one of the ones that is demonstrating what they were bred for. And they can always be lemons in any of these dogs. There can be a lemon of a herding dog, a lemon of a terrier, you know, a lemon of a husky, the husky that never leaves your side, the border collie that never comes when called, you know, the beagle that can't track a rabbit to save their life. You know, there's always lemons. And so there could always be, you know, a bulldog that would be the worst fighter on the face of the planet, and they are. And of course, unfortunately, they get turned into bait dogs out there in the fighting world. But what we have to keep in mind is that if the dog is good at what they were bred for, it's not the dog's fault, and it doesn't mean they're vicious, and it doesn't mean they're bad. It means they are what the breeders intended the dog to be. So we want to just be smart and avoid the kinds of trouble zones for any of these dogs. I mean, I'm not going to allow my border collie to get near the neighbor's sheep either, right? Because he's going to harass the daylights out of them, especially if he hasn't been trained on formal herding. So, you know, we all have these caveats we have to keep in mind. And I will say bulldogs are the most fun-loving, good-natured, sociable, outgoing, tolerant, patient. I mean, compared to many of the other types of dogs, they're exceedingly good-natured. It's just we have to keep in mind they're very powerful, capable animals when it comes to altercation.
I used to joke when my friend with the pit bull was living with me that if someone broke in my house, that Shaka might lick them to death.
A pit bull are going to be the worst home protection ever if no one is deterred by just their physique alone.
Yeah. But when my friend moved here to Austin, he had a hard time finding an apartment to rent that would allow a pit bull. Austin's right. The most dog-friendly city in the world. There's dogs everywhere, but most apartment complexes won't allow what they call aggressive breeds.
Right. And really, what the unfortunate thing is that people aren't having the practical conversation. And my hope with the book is that we can all start to get a little more practical about these things because, you know, there are a lot of dogs that are going to be far more quick to the draw than bulldogs. And, you know, yet, of course, they get the name as being, you know, the dogs that are vicious natured and, you know, looking to hurt people, as well as many other breeds that have gotten just
right.
Put
well,
on
one
that
problem
list.
Is
and,
that little dogs often tend to try and attack. A little dog will act aggressively towards the pit. I've seen mm-hmm. this time and time again. And the problem, of course, is that if the little dog actually attacks and the pit fights back, that's the end of the little dog.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. And really what we're talking about there is a physics issue, isn't it?
You yes.
know, because the little dog may sit there and poke the bear and, you know, be very threatening and fractious in their expression. And the bulldog may be walking by completely minding their own business. But, you know, if they, again, find themselves in an altercation, then they're very efficient.
Right.
And
right.
that's because they were bred to be good at it. You know, historically, humans, unfortunately, have always had an obsession with blood sport and gladiator-type entertainment with animals and people alike. And, you know, that's where the history, the unfortunate history of the bulldog comes in, and they didn't ask for it. And there's no bulldog I've met that wants to hurt somebody, right? But genes happen to the animal, to the individual, as much as they happen to the people that are watching or around or on the other end of it. You know, a herding dog doesn't know why they want to hurt. You know, a scent hound doesn't know why they want to track the animal. They find themselves, you know, taken over by genetics as the environment triggers something that then stimulates the genetic software program to run, and it's happening to them. You know, that there's no executive function, no decision-making involved in it.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kim Brophy, author of Meet Your Dog, The Game-Changing Guide to Understanding Your Dog's Behavior. Kim, would you like to read a little bit from the book?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Got a section in the introduction I thought that I would share.
Perfect.
The fairy tale pet. We get a dog. We take him home and give him a name. We buy him food, a bed, some toys, a leash, a collar with his name on it. We take him to the vet to get his shots. We take him out on walks, brush his coat, and kiss him goodnight. He is our pet. Most of us were born into a world in which the idea of a pet dog is normal. But not so many years ago, the entire idea was pretty absurd. While dogs may have been pets on a relative scale in various cultures throughout history, the practice of bringing them into our homes as captive, full-time consumers and family members is far more recent. It is also mostly unique to modern, developed countries like the United States. The entire pet industry has emerged and subsequently exploded in little more than 60 years, feeding an impractical and unrealistic perception of the dogs in our lives in order to attract our attention to their more marketable needs. In 2016, Americans spent over $62 billion on their pets,
a figure projected to keep growing by leaps and bounds. A pet industrial complex has emerged to cater to the billions of dollars consumers are willing to spend, from beef-flavored Prozac to smocked dresses and spa treatments for dogs. Endless gourmet treats and toys, daycare visits, dog park playdates, personal groomers and trainers, and better medical and dental care than many Americans receive. These are the standard amenities for many pet dogs. Born, as most of us were, into this pet dog era, we rarely question these preconceptions and practices. In recent times, dog behavior problems have become increasingly common and severe, with communities struggling to navigate everything from bites and lawsuits to overcrowded shelters filled with unwanted dogs. This means that certain myths about the needs and natures of our so-called pet dogs need to be examined. Every day in my practice, I pass a box of tissues to another desperate dog lover sharing deep frustrations and heartache in their first consultation. A few examples. Wally cracked a tooth breaking out of the crate and destroyed the Persian rug and new designer curtains. Though Donna and her husband have given up on date nights and Sunday drives in order to take turns babysitting the dog 24/7 and to help cover the bills. Buddy and Boomer have been fighting so much that they have to be separated at all times and can no longer be walked together. This doubles the amount of time Ron spends trudging around the neighborhood in the dead of winter waiting for the dogs to pee instead of helping the kids with their homework. No one in Patty's house has had a full night's sleep since they brought Dolly back to Manhattan after that trip to the Smoky Mountains. Her howling at sirens has resulted in 3 noise violations in 3 weeks. And Leroy won't let Lexi's new boyfriend back in the bed at 3 a.m. She had to remove the little snarling beast from his arm 2 nights ago. The guy has, understandably, dropped a few sour hints that she needs to choose between him and the dog. Like thousands of other unhappy dog owners, these clients have been searching diligently, if unsuccessfully, for answers to their dog's behavior problems. Internet searches, advice from friends, and reruns of dog training shows turned up some pretty confusing information. What they were finding and hearing just didn't add up. Intuitively, they sensed something profound was missing. This is the missing link. We don't have the big picture. We've forgotten that dogs are animals. We've forgotten that there are major differences between different types of dogs, but we fail to meet their specific behavioral needs. We struggle to train them to be as we wish them to be, expecting the wrong behaviors from our canine companions. We need to understand that it's not their behavior, but our expectations about their behavior that are broken. Our pet culture has failed to question the fundamental soundness of what we ask of our dogs in our day-to-day lives. When we have company over, when we pass other dogs on the street, when we leave our dog alone in a crate for over 10 hours a day, when the neighborhood kids barrel through the front door at all hours unannounced. There are very good reasons why some dogs handle these kinds of events with ease and why others come apart at the seams. Put simply, we can't have the same expectations for a German Shepherd that we would for a pug. Treating all dogs as if they were the same, operating from a standard recipe, and ignoring their elemental variations sets them and us up for certain failure.
That's for sure.
And that's the basis of the legs system to make sure that you're selecting the right dog for the environment, for what you need and what the dog needs.
Right.
And you need to have that in mind before you go looking for a dog, because you might fall in love with one that isn't going to fit too well, right?
That's right, and it happens all too often, so we can avoid heartache by having those conversations beforehand.
Yeah, right.
And you have some great stories in the book about people who had dogs that, like you said before, they felt they were broken because they were behaving in a way that didn't meet expectations. But once you actually figure out what's causing the behavior for them, you're not necessarily able to fix the dog, but you're able to fix the situation.
You know, and I love how you phrased that right there, because we had a mantra here at the dog door in my behavior center as we're working with clients that we tell owners to repeat over and over again to themselves. Control the environment, not the dog. Mm. If you control the environment, then that's how you affect the behavior. And we have spent so long just beating our head against the wall in a battle of wills, trying to force that square peg in a round hole to control the dog. And really, this is about appreciating that bigger picture and stepping back out of that battle of wills and recognizing all the things we can change in the circumstances. I can't tell you how many times people have come into the behavior center thinking that they have a behavior problem and thinking they need to fix or train the dog and ready for this daunting, intimidating, months-long behavior plan. And I say, you know what? If you just change this one thing, you don't actually even have a problem. And they look at you and they're scraping their chin off the floor, and they start crying half of the time, and they say, oh, you know, I have been losing sleep over this. Is it really that simple? Gosh, I never thought about that. You mean I don't have to do it this way? And if I just change that piece, yep, that's as simple as it is. And almost in 25, 50% of our cases, maybe even, there are these little details, these circumstances, these little dynamics that you can shift that suddenly shift the whole relationship, the behavior of the dog, the dynamic. And so our job is to kind of be sleuths when it comes to legs and figure out where the dysfunction is occurring and what we can do about it to solve it.
Kim, can you give us some examples of that, of some just little change that made a huge difference?
You know, one of the easiest ones that I can think about would be something like a dog that is living in a highly sedentary indoor lifestyle who's a natural athlete. And even some of the most agreeable dogs on earth, like in the gun dog group, are very athletic animals. And sometimes someone might have had a dog before that they could just walk four times a day for 10-minute pee breaks, and that would cut it. And so they are now in a condo, and they went and got themselves a young Weimaraner and, you know, are doing just those three or four potty break exercise events a day because they're working long hours. They have no fenced yard because they're in a condo, and the dog is very destructive, and they think they have separation anxiety because he keeps eating the blinds and peeing all over the carpet and eating the pillows, when actually the dog doesn't have separation anxiety. They're just bored out of their ever-loving mind. So a combination, for instance, of, you know, increased exercise, whether that's a dog walker or a runner, a quality daycare, and I emphasize quality there really intentionally, you know, something to be able to give that dog the athletic and social outlets that they need on a daily basis can suddenly, you know, resolve the behavior that's occurring in the home on a daily basis when the dog is confined and alone indoors for inordinate amounts of time.
Well, that same Siberian Husky that I was talking about earlier, when I moved into town and I tried to take the dog into town with me, even having a fenced-in backyard, I couldn't keep him in the yard. Mm-hmm. If I kept him in, I mean, he would jump the fence no matter what. Mm-hmm. When I tried to keep him in the house, he tore down the blinds. Actually, it was a she. She almost clawed through a door. Mm-hmm. And I took her back out in the country where, you know, admittedly out there, she was allowed to go in and out as she pleased. And she went in the house and stayed there for 3 days. So it wasn't the fact that she was in the house. It was just that she didn't have the choice.
Oh, gosh. You know, you just hit such a nail on the head. So in animal husbandry and animal welfare, which is really what applied ethology is, it's animal welfare for captive and domesticated species as it relates to their interactions with people. It's a good way to think about it. But, you know, in that consideration, do you know what one of the most well-researched and proven components of welfare is? Choice. Mm. Choice and control. And what's so interesting is that the more we've selected for domestication, okay? So the more that we've selected for away from their natural ancestry, right, away from those natural roots, the more we've made dogs tolerant for reduction to choice. And the closer they are to those ancestral roots, the less they're having of it. And so a husky, any of the natural dogs, you know, the whole idea that we can take away that autonomy is fought with a vengeance. You know, any wild animal that you try to trap or enclose or remove those options of choice and control, you are going to get so much more frustration than if you are domesticating, which is basically the selection against aggression and the selection for tolerance and frustration, tolerance temperament in and around people. So whenever we've bred for this companionship, we're breeding for something actually called neoteny, which is the preservation of juvenile traits throughout adulthood. So in other words, perma babies, perma Peter Pans, with the golden retriever being kind of the poster child for that, right? And so that passivity, right, of a puppy, you know, they're more passive and more cooperative and more complacent. All of that is a genetic side effect of that selection for temperament and domestication.
Interesting. Wow. So Kim, let's talk a little bit about your writing process. Now, is this your first book?
It is.
It is. And what made you decide to take your system and make a book out of it?
I think I felt there was just a tremendous gap in terms of the publications that were out there. If you're looking at it as legs, there's a lot of L books out there for dog behavior and training, for pet dog lovers, and a lot of learning books out there. And then there are some books that might talk just about the S, like the self, the health, the nutrition, et cetera. But there wasn't a lot to talk about that E and the G and the relationship between those two things, in the way that zoologists have long appreciated that it matters for wild animals in zoos and captive environments. So I felt like I wanted to be able to give to a wider audience, to the country, to the world, what I was able to help explain and put in the hands of my clients here at the Dog Door Behavior Center in Asheville.
And the E and the G are environment and genetics.
And exactly.
Which, yeah, are definitely key in as we've been discussing.
Right. And if you think about it, are the things that we talk about the least.
Yes. And how did you decide how to structure and organize the book?
Well, you are looking at the third rendition of manuscripts, of course, right, is often the process for writers. So the first book was structured differently and more academically. So when I was first writing the book, I was writing it for my professional peers, trying to convince my own field that these things mattered, and I wanted or thought, hoped that the information would trickle down. And then the second manuscript was me trying to ride the fence of two audiences, which of course never works, with one foot writing it for my peers and one foot writing it for dog owners. And the voice was too distinctly different and changing back and forth, the writer's voice. And so ultimately I committed to writing this book for dog lovers, and decided to have the voice be very intimate and speaking directly to the person and their relationship with their dog, because I felt that this was going to be a cultural change that would be grassroots and from the bottom up, and that people were in a better position to create the paradigm shift and ultimately put pressure on the industry to get on board with the bigger picture of life.
Now, the book, there's a lot of sort of graphic elements to the book as well, from photographs of the various dogs to the way the pages are edged in color by the LEGS, the charts and the scores, the public life score and home life score. And so did you do all that, or did you have help with all of that?
Oh, it was a wonderfully dynamic process with Chronicle Publishing, who I can't say enough good things about. But Chronicle, of course, is very well known for visual quality productions and books, and they do a lot of instructive types of publications, a lot of pictures, a lot of graphs, a lot of visual elements, and so they definitely brought wonderful ideas to the table. And so I don't remember, you know, who came up with which ones here and there, but it was a great dynamic process with my editor. I loved, for instance, I think it was her idea to do the color coding of the edges of the pages based on the chapters, which I just thought was a great concept. And, you know, from the beginning, I had the idea that I wanted to have some different visual representations of the different groups of dogs. Different photographs, so it wasn't just one picture for each group, and I wanted to have one of the dog kind of behaving as they were bred to behave, and make sure that people could kind of see the dog in action. And a fun story is it's my current husband who is the photographer for the book, so that was a fun process to do with him as well.
Oh, cool. And you also have world maps that show where each of the groups of dogs originated.
Right. Yeah, that was also the publisher's idea.
And there, I don't know if you have it for all of, I think you do. You have some vintage photos of the dogs.
Yes. Yeah, there's one for each of the sections. And so what I wanted was for people to connect to the history, because I think what I noticed was how disconnected we are from that now, thinking of them all as pets. It's kind of like, oh, that's interesting. I heard those dogs used to be used for this. But there's something different that happens to us when we see it, when we see old art or photography of a dog being used for the job for which they were selected, in their element, so to speak.
Yes. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. How did you get connected with Chronicle Books? We've done quite a few authors from Chronicle, and they absolutely make the most beautiful books on the market. How did you connect with them as your publisher?
I had an agent, ICM, in New York, and my agent was actually, it's funny, she had someone from Chronicle in her office just by chance a few years ago when we were pitching the book to various publishers. And they were just having a conversation, and the editor from Chronicle perked up and was very interested in the project. And so they called me, you know, the next week, and it went from there.
Now, writers often say that getting the agent's the hard part. Was that
right?
A difficult challenge for you?
Well, you know, I had a stroke of wonderful luck. Alexander Horowitz is a colleague of mine who is also a best-selling author. And I had spoken with her on a number of occasions, and we had gone back and forth on a couple projects we were working on with a company called Camp Unleashed that does wonderful camps for people with their dogs. Something else to look into that's a blast. The founder of that, Annie Brody, is also a mutual friend of Alexandra Horowitz and myself. So Alexandra was kind enough, when she found out that I was writing the book, to refer me to her agent and create that introduction. So I think sometimes that is the hardest part, is getting the agent. And if you have a wonderful opportunity of just getting a personal connection, it's definitely worth snagging it.
And did you... at the point where you got the agent, was the book pretty much written at that point, or did you still have a lot to do?
Oh, no. It was at that point we were still on kind of manuscript one. And we did have a proposal. We had a formal, very nice book proposal that we had put together. But Chronicle was really amazing in terms of the level of investment and interplay that they had with me as an author and a first-time author. They believed in the vision of the book, and they felt that the writing was solid, and they were also very heavily invested in the process of ensuring it was the best product it could possibly be.
And the book was released about a month ago. Is that true?
the end of March, yep.
End of March. And what kind of response has it had in the marketplace?
Oh, it's been incredibly well received. And, you know, of course, any one of us, right, when we write a book, you just kind of put it out there and you cross your fingers and you hope your baby is well received out there in the world. But, you know, it is such a paradigm shifter that you just hope that people are able to embrace it and understand it. Because I think anytime we're really challenged to look at something so differently, there's the risk that it'll be threatening or uncomfortable in some way for the readers. And I've gotten nothing but the most positive, very deeply sincere feedback from both dog lovers, owners, as well as colleagues and other dog professionals. And it's really helped to light a match within my local community, as well as my professional community, to up the level of conversation about dogs, not just in the world of training and behavior, but in the pet industry as a whole. And we're doing a lot here, starting in Asheville, and with the hopes of taking that on a national scale to go beyond the current concept of dog training, beyond this current concept of dog daycare, beyond the current concept of animal welfare, to create new standards and implement legs as a new model within the entire pet industry in these various different types of professions.
Well, Kim, I imagine that writing the book actually took a lot of time. Do you plan to do more writing, or are you just going to focus on the doing from here on?
I am really focused on the doing. You know, I've enjoyed writing the book tremendously, but I think my kids would croak if I told them I was going to write another book. It's been such a sacrifice for them. You know, running a full-time business here at the Behavior Center, being a mom, I mean, this was more on my plate than I had room for, but we did it anyway because we believed in it. And yet I don't think I'll be writing another one anytime soon, just because what I want to do now that the information and the book is out there is I really want to work on these projects with my community members here, with my clients, as well as with pet professionals nationwide, to help them implement legs in their own company.
Well, that sounds like a good plan.
But how do we get this? How can we get this book? Where is it available?
It's pretty much wherever books are sold. So Amazon, of course, has the book, and Barnes & Noble, as well as a number of other retailers and distributors. We, of course, have it for sale here at the Dog Door Behavior Center. And if people want to call us up and ask us about their own dog and, you know, get a copy from us, we're happy to do that as well.
Great. And, of course, you can always order from your own independent bookstore, which we love to
Absolutely.
Support. Well, thank you so
yes,
much for being with us today, Kim.
Thank you for having me.
Mom, do you have some final words?
Well, I do, because it's understanding your pet's natural instincts can make your life together so much easier and so much more enjoyable. And this book certainly will help you achieve that. So I recommend it highly.
Great. Thanks so much, and see you next week on Writer's Voices.